You are listening to Breadbox Media Podcast. Check out our live stream at breadboxmedia.com. Breadbox Media. Get the app, change the world.
Good morning, friend. Welcome in hour two of the Mike Allen Show here on this Tuesday, December 13th. We passed Gaudete Sunday now. We're kind of in the home stretch. Not too late. Still invest yourself in this Advent season and avail yourself of the profound mysteries and the life-changing grace that God continues to offer through the life, death, and resurrection of His Son. My pleasure to be with you today. We're going to be talking in the next segment to Matt Swaim. Matt Swaim, who works with the Coming Home Network, with an organization that is devoted to helping persons who are on the journey to the Catholic faith. I found myself in need of the ministry and the work of Coming Home, the Coming Home Network, when I found myself as a Methodist pastor and a Methodist Christian who had started as a journey of simple intellectual curiosity about Catholicism, which morphed into an appreciation for the beauties of Catholicism, which morphed, therefore, into an attraction to the beauties of Catholicism, which then morphed into a recognition and a realization that I had been thoroughly hooked, believed in the Catholic faith, and faced a crisis of sorts that would upset my vocational life and my whole means of support and my family and everything in becoming Catholic. Coming Home Network is an organization devoted to helping persons along that journey through mutual support, through direction and so forth, and just a safe place to be able to talk about their concerns, because there are big ones. And one thing that happens sometimes, this is what I'm going to talk to Matt Swaim about in the next segment, is you may find yourself entering into the Catholic Church and being the only Catholic in your family, maybe even the only Catholic in your family for generations, which certainly is the case with me, besides people who may be married in to one of my relatives. But in terms of my bloodline, I don't know of any other Catholics before me in my family life. I mean, I'm sure you'd have to go back to probably before the Protestant Reformation in my genealogy. And so it does create some interesting dynamics, particularly around the holidays, when you're visiting with family, maybe even staying with family, whether it's, and you've got to decide, you've got that sort of awkward idea that you need to go to Mass, right? Maybe everybody else are Presbyterians or Baptists or Methodists, and they all want you to go to church with them, which is the church you grew up in, but you also feel like you want to go to Mass. It is part of your own Christian obligation. We say that like it's a bad word. Obligation simply means, you know, where there are a lot of things we're obliged to do. It doesn't mean that's the only reason we do them. I mean, I'm a married man. I'm obliged to be faithful to my wife. Hopefully it doesn't feel like an obligation. You know what I mean? But, so how do you navigate that? How do you slip away with the very obvious elephant in the room that you're going to Mass? We'll talk to Matt Swaim about that. I know he put that question out there in the Coming Home Network. We'll see maybe what kind of feedback he's gotten. Also want to talk a little bit more about this song, Baby, It's Cold Outside, which has come under great scrutiny. Maybe part of familiarity brings contempt. We hear these Christmas songs so many times, and I'm not sure really Baby, It's Cold Outside, is it even really a Christmas song? But it's become associated with this time of year. And it's been alternately criticized as being a song about date rape or celebrated as a song of feminist empowerment. But I really want to zero in primarily on the song's quaintness in the woman who narrates or who's part of this dialogue between a man and a woman in the song, which I'm sure you know it. But the almost quaint nature of the concern that she has about whether her reputation will suffer because of suspicions and rumors and innuendo, because she stays too long or even overnight with a young man, and yet we live in a world where the vast majority of couples getting married move in together beforehand. There are even those who have no need for marriage. They just simply cohabit. We've largely lost stigma associated with premarital sex, I think, in the broader culture. So I am asking a question of the day today, whether you think that's primarily a good thing or a bad thing. And I don't think you're necessarily, in saying that, making a judgment about whether you think premarital sex itself is good or bad, but maybe you think stigma has a useful place in a culture, stigma and shame for deterring certain behaviors, or maybe you think, you know, it's about time we left stigma and shame behind and let people simply engage their reason on this issue. So do you think destigmatization has been a good thing or a bad thing? Is it a good thing that we no longer send pregnant teenage girls away to live with a distant relative, and so forth? 573-4BREAD-4 if you want to chime in, or you can email me, MikeAllenShow@gmail.com, MikeAllenShow@gmail.com. We'll also talk about the world's most politically dangerous book. It's not what others claim it is, by the way. We'll get into all that on the program today. It is the feast day of St. Lucy, Virgin and Martyr, so we ask for St. Lucy to pray for us. We were talking a little bit about the parable for the Mass reading for today, Gospel of Matthew, chapter 21. It's an interesting selection tucked in here with still 12 days away for the Feast of the Nativity. We've passed that pink candle third Sunday of Advent, which means the light is growing and our time is hastening to a close. And there may be a temptation in someone's mind to say, well, you know, if I haven't really availed my heart of God's grace in a significant way this Advent, it's maybe too late to do it. If we need convincing that it's not too late, and by the way, this is the beauty of, I think, the Catholic faith as a whole. All we need to look at is the encounter that Jesus has with the crucified criminal near him there at Calvary to understand that as long as we have breath in our body, that it's never too late. Whatever we've done, whomever we've been, whatever choices we've made, even if our impending death is the fruit of our own choices, as long as we have breath in our bodies, we are never too late to turn. I think one of the really poignant, if you've ever seen, there are several versions of films about St. Thérèse of Lisieux, but the great delight she took as a young girl, when there was a man who was condemned to die that she had heard of for his crimes, and she was praying for him, even as a young girl, the signs of sanctity already evident. She was praying and praying and praying that this murderer, when presented with the cross before his execution, the crucifix, as all in France who were executed would be presented a crucifix by a priest, she prayed that he would kiss it. That in that last opportunity and moment for receiving grace, that he would do just that. And it's really beautiful, the passion that she exhibited in her prayers for that, rooted in this conviction that it's never too late. And so Jesus tells this parable to the chief priests and the elders of the people. A man had two sons. He came to the first and said, "Son, go out and work in the vineyard today." The son said in reply, "I will not." But afterwards he changed his mind and went. And the man came to his other son and gave the same order. "Yes, I will go." But ultimately he did not. Jesus asks, which of the two did his father's will? Of course, this is a setup, of course, right? He asks the question and they respond, the chief priests and elders, of course, the first. Jesus said to them, "Amen, I say to you, tax collectors and prostitutes are entering the kingdom of God before you." In other words, your status as chief priests and elders, the outward appearance of your own fidelity, is not reflected in your openness to the kingdom of God. This is why tax collectors and prostitutes, like the first son who said, I will not, but then changed his mind and went, as opposed to the second who gave forward the positive appearance that he would go, but in fact did not. It's the tax collectors and prostitutes who are entering the kingdom of God before you. And as I said, this should keep us sort of from these twin poles when it comes to our own hearts and lives, when it comes to other people that we know, even when it comes to our children. Maybe we've experienced what the father in this parable did. We presume we know which child is the compliant one and which one is not. It's amazing how those roles can change over the years. But the twin pole errors of presumption, right? The idea that I will always be attentive and open to the will of God, as opposed to others who reject it, should keep us from presumption, because there but for the grace of God go we. And this process of salvation, you know, we can always go from being, in the, to use another parable of Jesus, from wheat to being a weed, or vice versa. So it should keep us from presumption. It also should keep us from despair. The feeling that, you know what, I've already wrecked my life. There's no changing it. There's no turning it around. There's no hope for me. Or I've already let this Advent go by. Too late. Might as well just mail it in. No, it's never too late. If you've got breath in your body, by God's grace, He draws us, invites us, calls us. It's never too late. We just have to give Him our yes. We'll be back in just a minute with my friend Matt Swaim. We'll talk about navigating those awkward mass attendance moments. This is The Mike Allen Show.
You are listening to Breadbox Media Podcast. Check out our live stream at breadboxmedia.com. Breadbox Media. Get the app, change the world.
Fifteen minutes past the hour, you're back on the Mike Allen Show. Here on this feast day of St. Lucy, Lucy, Virgin and Martyr. Pleased to have on the phone, well, actually with us via Skype from Washington, D.C., Matt Swaim. He's the communications coordinator for the Coming Home Network, an organization that exists really for accompanying people who are find themselves on a journey of whether it's curiosity, attraction, or ultimately conviction of coming into the Catholic Church, and oftentimes from non-Catholic Protestant backgrounds as clergy and all the challenges that that involves. So, Matt, good morning.
Good morning, Mike. How are you?
I'm doing well. We were talking off air there. Your first Christmas in D.C., it's a very interesting time to be living in the nation's capital, I would imagine.
It is that, although I'm told we're all going to be forced to say Merry Christmas, so I guess that's good.
That's going to be a city ordinance? Is that what we're looking
city
at?
City ordinance, yes, yes.
by federal fiat?
Federal fiat, and there's going to be a lot of people who are not going to be as agreeable as our Blessed Mother on that. But I don't know. It's a very interesting time, as you say.
Yes. Sorry about your Bengals, by the way. Kind of not a good year.
Not so much.
But there's always college basketball. So
there is always college basketball and Big Blue.
There you go, the Kentucky Wildcats. So anyway, let's talk. I saw this question that popped up. I know you like to put these questions out there and get people's feedback. And I thought this was very interesting. I'd not seen it posed before. How do you manage mass attendance when visiting non-Catholic family for the holidays? That's one of these community questions you ask on the Coming Home Network. This, I think, a very apt one, particularly for your audience, for people who find themselves maybe as the only Catholic in their families, and all of a sudden they come together for these, you know, you're forced to be together, in a sense, at these holiday gatherings, and yet you have this, you know, that you have not only the Mass obligation, but, you know, your desire to go to Mass, but it's this elephant in the room, and how do you deal with it?
Yeah, so as you mentioned on the lead into this, our goal is not to necessarily answer all those questions about, you know, do Catholics worship Mary or whatever. Our goal really is, once you've felt led along that path, what are the practical implications of this decision? And few things are as practical and have as many implications as, you know, actually living this out when you're with your family. So, for instance, if you're visiting at Christmas and you got to get to Mass, and say, for instance, you've decided you want to go on Christmas morning and it's right in the middle of when everybody's planned on opening stockings, you know, or maybe it's, you know, midnight Mass, and that's just as things are getting cranked up and you're heading out the door for perhaps even your 10 o'clock Mass. So people don't understand. One of the things that came up, first of all, is that one of our readers had suggested just be firm and clear about it. That's something that I was not good at the beginning. So, for instance, you know, when I'd be visiting my family on the weekend, I would say something to the effect of, we were kind of sort of thinking about maybe looking into the possibility of checking to see about going to the 8:30 Mass tomorrow. Well, if you do that, Mike, how serious do you think I am about it? Not very, right?
Right, sure. I mean, you're open to being talked out of it, is what it
exactly
sounds like.
Exactly. You're basically asking them to tell you to not go, to reconsider. So if you just make it clear, hey, we're planning on going to the 8:30 Mass tomorrow. Is there anything that we need to necessarily be back for? What's our schedule? You know, that kind of thing, like making sure that we don't miss out on brunch with Mama, because if Mama ain't happy, ain't nobody happy. So, I mean, it's clear to – I mean, it's important to be clear, because, A, it shows it's important to you that you're going, and B, you know, well, here's the thing. If you say with firm intent that you're planning on going, if you show that you enjoy going, that you're going not just because you have to, but because you want to, then even people who don't understand will have some modicum of respect for what you're doing, because they realize, I don't know what's going on, but it's important to Matt, so let him do his thing.
You know, I had this situation. I kind of run into this every year, because we do this large extended family thing weekend in Gatlinburg. We just did it this past weekend, actually. And, of course, you know, my wife and I were the only – and our children were the only Catholics in the group. For years, we went there before we were Catholic. Now, you know, that is now being a part of it. We had one weekend, though, where we had the Saturday was the Feast of the Immaculate Conception. And then Sunday, so we had to find a way to extricate ourselves to go to Mass twice, let alone, you know, how do you explain that it's the Feast of the Immaculate Conception of the Blessed Virgin Mary?
Yeah. Yeah, then you might open a couple of discussions. You're dialoguing, Mike. Dialoguing.
That's exactly right. Do you think some of it is, too, you know, especially when you come maybe from a Protestant background, they don't really understand why, for example, why does it have to be a Catholic church? Why can't you just go to, you know, First Baptist like you did growing up, and that count, so to speak? You know what I mean?
Right. And that's where the rubber hits the road, right? That's where you start to have discussions, you know, that might give a little insight. But you don't have to go, you know, full whole hog, you know, pontifical, you know, commission on ecumenical dialogue with somebody. You don't. You can just say, listen, the Mass is important. You know, my body, my, you know, church celebrates this all as one around the world, and it's important to me to be a part of that. And here's the other thing, too. And I was thinking about this the other day. We have holy days of obligation in the Catholic Church. But I remember growing up, as a Methodist and a Nazarene, and you probably remember this too as a Methodist pastor, that there are kind of like unspoken holy days of obligation in certain Protestant traditions. I mean, I've known people who Wednesday night was a holy day of obligation every week, no matter who you were and where you were.
Oh, sure.
You know, Sunday night was a holy day of obligation, sort of. And actually, it wasn't even necessarily a holy day of obligation. It was Sunday night service was how you could figure out who was really serious about Jesus, because whoever showed up on Sunday night was all in.
That was the church within the church, yes.
The church within the church. So people understand the idea of clearing their schedules. Your Christian family members will understand the idea of clearing your schedules, and this comes first. But it gets a little difficult kind of in this age that we're in now where there are certain churches. I mean, Christmas falls on, I believe, a Sunday this year.
Yes, correct.
And there's a church in your backyard that I know has canceled services on Sunday morning of Christmas because they thought, well, it's more important for you to be home with your family. So there's not this sense of urgency to unite yourself with the body and blood of Christ sacramentally in your Protestant brothers and sisters churches. If you got somebody who's an evangelical Lutheran Church of America attendee, when they visit your house 10 states over, they're not looking for the closest evangelical Lutheran Church of America to go to. So it's important to kind of help people understand that, you know, you're uniting yourself to this billion member body that is your family, your church family. Even if you can't see the people that you actually know in person, you're still united with that family. And I think that's, maybe for some people who are outside to Catholicism, that can give them a little bit of a window into, what it means to be part of a universal church.
Yeah, that's a great point. I don't think I'd thought of it in those terms. I mean, we do have, I think, on the whole, for the most part, as Catholics, a deeper sense of our communion with the greater body, with the worldwide, the universal, the Catholic Church. Therefore, every parish gives us that connection, no matter what town we're in a way that, maybe a Protestant church doesn't. I don't see any problem with, though, for example, assuming that you're comfortable with this, going to both, going to the Baptist church with your parents or whatever, but then finding a way to go to Mass. That seems like a battle not worth having if you can do both.
Well, and that's what I actually do when I go visit your neck of the woods, because that my family lives, my side of the family lives just south of you in the Lancaster area. And we go down to Saints Peter and Paul on Sunday mornings when we visit in Danville. And then we go to the early Mass, and we have time to go to my father's Sunday school class at his church. And actually, it's a co-Sunday school class that he and my mom teach together. And so we've gotten connected to our family of God in the Church Universal. And now we're getting, some Bible study with some Christians of goodwill and kind of an extended discussion format after that. And it's kind of, it's a way that shows people that, we're not trying to separate ourselves out from you and pretend like you're the unwashed and we're the holy, we're the elect and you're chopped liver. But rather it's a way to say that this is really important to us, but we love you and we're going to try and make it work on both ends. And I think that's an excellent point that you raise.
Well, and I guess you've also got the occasional situation too, where, you may be with fallen away Catholic, family members who don't have any desire to go to Mass. Maybe they're bitter at the church, so you got to navigate that too as well, which is a whole different conversation, I'm sure.
Yeah, and especially as some people have related in this ongoing conversation in our Coming Home Network forums, that look down on you for going to Mass because they feel like you're judging them,
right?
Because you're going and they're not. When that could be the farthest thing from your mind, right?
Yeah,
maybe.
Yeah.
Maybe you just wish that they would, you would be able to like invite them out of love instead of invite them and them take it as you giving them a guilt trip. So mm-hmm. These are huge issues that people deal with on a very practical level. And that's why I'm glad that in our forums and on our blog posts, on our Facebook page, people started to kind of throw in their two cents and some ideas.
Absolutely.
Because, no two situations are identical when it comes to this.
Matt, always a pleasure, and you're doing great work with the Coming Home Network. Blessings to you and to your family, and hopefully we'll see you soon.
You too, man. Come visit us at chnetwork.org.
Check it out. All right, Matt, thanks. We'll be back in a minute with more. This is the Mike Allen Show. You're listening to Breadbox Media.
You are listening to Breadbox Media Podcast. Check out our live stream at breadboxmedia.com. Breadbox Media. Get the app, change the world.
We're right at the bottom of the hour back on the Mike Allen Show here on Breadbox Media. Want to learn more about what we do? Just go to breadboxmedia.com. There's even a little helpful animated clip there explaining what Breadbox Media is about. Also, if you want to listen to podcasts, check out all of our different contributors, both in terms of daily shows as well as weekend shows. Then you can go to iTunes, Podbean, Google Play, find the podcast, listen to it. You can also subscribe there as well. Also, support your favorite show by becoming a friend of that show and through a monthly contribution. Not only have the pleasure of knowing you're supporting something you believe in, but also have access to exclusive online content, all that and more. Check it out, breadboxmedia.com. My question of the day is about the destigmatization of premarital sexual intercourse, or what they used to call back in the old days, the more stigmatizing term, I guess you could say, fornication. So my question is, do you think destigmatizing, whether or not you agree or disagree with the actual behavior, do you think destigmatizing is a good thing or a bad thing? Somebody took exception on my Facebook wall with the question, have we destigmatized it? And I think in many ways it has been within the culture anyway. I don't know else to explain the meteoric rise in, for example, premarital cohabitation, couples living together before marriage or outside of marriage, which is, at least for engaged couples, I think has risen about 1,100% since about 1960. And I think most people assume, of course, couples who are living together are sexually active. That doesn't mean they are, to be fair, right? But certainly I think that's the assumption. And by and large, people, it's just accepted. We just do. You know, it doesn't carry stigma, let's say, as it once did. And there was an interesting link that I posted with the question of the day on the show's Facebook page. And I'll try to put it back up again, or at least on my personal Facebook page, I think. In terms of premarital sex attitudes and practices. As I said, in 1900, only 6% of women would have engaged in premarital sex by the age of 19. Now, of course, it'd be interesting to ask how many women would be married by the age of 19. You might be surprised at that significant figure as well. There's probably some correlation of sorts between the rising age of marriage and the rising age of, the rise of premarital intercourse, right? Because if you're getting married at 17, then the chances of premarital sex are much lower than if you're getting married at 25 or 26. So that'd be another interesting question to ask, right? And part of the deal is that, you know, which has fed which? That'd be the question, right? Because perhaps the marriage age has increased because people no longer feel like they have to be married to justify their sexual behavior. And there used to be, it seems quaint, but there used to be a time when people saw marriage as the opportunity, therefore, to engage in respectable sexual behavior. Again, you know, there were always exceptions. But anyway, this is fascinating. In 1900, only 6% of women by the age of 19 would have engaged in premarital sex compared to 75% today. Public acceptance reacted with a lag. In 1968, only 15% of women had a permissive attitude toward the act, despite the fact that about 40% at the time of 19-year-old females had had premarital sex. And by 1983, the permissive attitude had jumped to 45%, and 73% of 19-year-olds at that time were sexually experienced. Anyway, so my question is, do you think the destigmatization is primarily a good thing or a bad thing? Shannon commenting again, saying another thing about stigma, it doesn't just shame the sinner, but also the family of the sinner. That isn't fair either, and it's really uncharitable. So what are your thoughts? 573-4BREAD-4, you can call or text, or you can email me, MikeAllenShow@gmail.com. You look at it, and as I said earlier, you know, this song, what prompted the question was the micro analysis that seems like being done on the song "Baby It's Cold Outside," which this time of year that you hear a lot, even though I don't even know that there is a Christmas reference in the actual lyrics of the song. Let me see. I've got the lyrics, I think, somewhere in here. for the song, as it is, as you know, that the basic pretext is it's a dialogue of sorts between the female lead and the voice of the male, right? So she starts by these half-hearted protests. I really can't stay. And he's saying, it's cold outside, you know. I have to go away. Baby, it's cold outside. You know, then all kind of these things. My mother will start to worry, she says. Hey, beautiful, what's your hurry? His reply. Father will be pacing the floor. He says, listen to that fireplace roar. So really, I'd better scurry. Beautiful, please don't hurry. And then you get into this whole issue, which is broad accusations that this is the date rape song, because she says, say, what's in this drink? He says, no cabs to be had out there, and so forth. But I saw an interesting defense of the song as a positive, not as a song that, you know, that compromises consent, in which a woman's no is not no. That's been part of the criticism against the song, is that it's anti-woman because it doesn't take her no for an answer. And let's face it, we live in a world where the moral qualification, or the determiner of the moral quality of any act, is all about consent. Anything done by mutual consent is fair game. The whole key is consent. But there was a defense of the song called Listening, from a blog, Listening While Feminist in Defense of Baby, It's Cold Outside. Persephonemagazine.com. Anyway, this is actually from a few years ago. This woman writing says, I've noticed over the last several years that some feminists have a strong dislike for the song Baby, It's Cold Outside. She said, I've heard the take on Baby as rapey a couple of times over the years, and the concern about the song usually centers in on one line, say, what's in this drink, which many contemporary listeners assume is a reference to a date rape drug. But narrowing in on this particular line divorces it from its own internal context, and having only passing familiarity with the song divorces it from its cultural context, she says. But a little bit later in the piece, you know, she questions this whole idea of whether consent is really being compromised. She said, as she's talking about leaving, she never says she doesn't want to stay. Her words are all based around other people's expectations of her. Her mother will worry. Her father will be pacing the floor. The neighbors will talk. Her sister will be suspicious of her excuses, and her brother will be furious. And she says, my favorite line that I think is incredibly revealing, my maiden aunt's mind is vicious. She says, vicious about what? Sex. Unmarried, non-good girl having sex. So she goes on to say, in essence, that, you know, that the song she sees as more positive, as a young woman who is breaking free from societal expectations and choosing to chart her own sexual course and so forth, which, of course, is the ultimate act of liberation. We shouldn't care about what others think. We need to break free from those constraints. Because the acting self, that's all that really matters. Power in your femininity. But when you read something like that, you think, man, maybe there is some value in actually considering societal stigmas and assumptions. As oftentimes, as messed up sometimes as the effect can be, we certainly don't want to promote judgmentalism, condemnation, all those sorts of things. At the same time, is there some value in stigma within a culture, in certain things being taboo? Do they, in many ways, sort of encapsulate and communicate the values of a culture and a society? So I can go back and forth. I can see where, you know, stigma and shame and those sorts of things can be destructive. And certainly, I think, are limited in their power to guide and shape behavior, because we need to have internal motivations that are more, that I think engage our reasoning, not just a fear of others' expectations. At the same time, I think stigma can can play a purpose. I know I sound like I'm trying to have both sides, and I guess I kind of am here. This is why I need your inputs and thoughts. 573-4BREAD-4, 573-4BREAD-4. There's also an interesting piece in The Atlantic by Connor Friedersdorf, who thinks that social conservatives should focus less on trying to reestablish stigma against permissive sexual behaviors and mores, and should try instead to focus in their energy on destigmatizing those who choose to resist the cultural trends and to be chaste. Because it's sort of this reversal of things that Friedersdorf mentions, he himself being a social liberal. But he says now we've come to a place where stigma is attached to the person who chooses not to embrace the permissive sexual climate. And maybe social conservatives should work instead to try to eliminate that stigma so that persons are free, whichever they choose, to make their decisions stigma-free. I don't know. It's very complicated. If you want to chime in, MikeAllenShow@gmail.com or call or text 573-4BREAD-4. We'll be back. This is The Mike Allen Show.
You are listening to Breadbox Media Podcast. Check out our live stream at breadboxmedia.com. Breadbox Media. Get the app. Change the world.
Minutes before the hour, we're back on the Mike Allen Show on a Tuesday that feels like a Monday to me. I was, of course, out of town all weekend. Gatlinburg, our annual family gathering, my mom and her husband very generously renting a house there in Gatlinburg. We've done this for 17 consecutive years, and my sisters and us and their families and our family. There are 15 grandchildren. They were not all here this time, but there was a future daughter-in-law or granddaughter-in-law because my nephew getting married this Saturday in Raleigh, North Carolina, will be heading out for that as well. But great gathering. You know, there were a couple seasons there. Interestingly, we've been in three different of these cabins. One we're in now is called Cabin Fever. We were in one called the Serenity. Serenity was the name of the cabin. And ironically enough, we were staying in Serenity when I think we had something like, yeah, I guess we were still in Serenity when we had 15 children ages 13 and under. Makes me think of Frank Costanza, Serenity now! But we've developed this tradition. We always eat the same foods in the weekend. And this is why I'm going to have to be more serious this week about my dietary intake, because Friday night my mom makes her outstanding chili. Always had it. I mean, 17 years. Chili on the opening night, and it's this, you know, sort of got a little bit of, it's this type Cincinnati, Ohio type chili with a little bit of cinnamon in it. Don't knock it till you've tried it. Then Saturday morning, my sister, older sister, fixes breakfast. These huge Cinnabon-ish cinnamon rolls and sausage gravy and biscuits. Oh. And then Saturday night, my younger sister and her husband, quesadillas. This is the tradition. And then Sunday morning, homemade pancakes. That's my specialty. Chocolate chip pancakes, bacon, sausage, all the rest. Then we eat leftovers pretty much the rest of the time that we're there. So, like I said, I got to get back on the good eating train, but Gatlinburg, a culinary Xanadu of sorts. Anyway, comfort foods all the way around. So glad to be back with you. Some things, of course, unfolding over the weekend. I'm fascinated about what's going on in Ohio right now when it comes to abortion legislation. Evidently, there are two potential bills before Governor John Kasich.
One that would outlaw abortion called the Fetal Heartbeat Bill, I believe it's being termed, would outlaw abortion after 6 weeks. And another one that would outlaw abortion, I think, that is based primarily on fetal pain on 20 weeks. And will, you know, Governor Kasich will choose one of those to sign, or he will sign neither one of them. Evidently, if he doesn't sign them, then they become law. And so he could veto, or he could sign, basically, are the options that he has. Now, this is kind of one of those situations where we're going to find out about the particular commitments of politicians who claim to be pro-life. Because we see this, and we this has been argued all through the most recent presidential campaign. We voters who purport to care about the unborn and who vote for ostensibly pro-life politicians, or at least politicians who claim they will work to establish and protect by law the unborn human person. We have not tended, quite frankly, to ask much of those elected officials once they get in office, because this is why many pro-life voters feel like they are largely used and taken advantage of. And so this is why there's going to be a pressure on Donald Trump, for example, to put his money where his mouth is on this issue. He's got two houses of Congress supposedly with him and so forth. Same thing with John Kasich. Now, there are a lot of things, I guess, as a governor, you've got to think about. For example, you know, how enforceable are these laws? How realistic are they in terms of whether they'll withstand Supreme Court scrutiny and all the rest? A lot of assumptions being made here about the type of Supreme Court justices Donald Trump will nominate, then when these cases, these laws would be challenged, if they would be, which they probably will, who will be wearing the black robes in Washington when it finally comes before the court. So keeping a close eye on this, my guess is that Kasich will sign the 20-week ban, not the 6-week ban at this point. In fact, I think Ohio Right to Life is more in favor of the 20-week ban, which they see as a more incremental approach, where the 6-week ban perhaps would be a little bit of an overreach. We'll see. You know, and there are all kind of different perspectives in the pro-life cause, whether a more realistic approach or a more idealistic approach is the way to go. Another big development, of course, it now looks like Donald Trump is going to be nominating Rex Tillerson as Secretary of State. If you're not familiar with that name, then you're probably not alone. But Rex Tillerson, evidently the longtime CEO of Exxon, with no political experience and no governmental diplomacy experience as well. But then again, we just elected a president with no political experience as well. So, you know, there's a piece here on Forbes.com. Rumors continue to percolate that President-elect Trump will nominate Rex Tillerson, the 64-year-old CEO of ExxonMobil, to be Secretary of State. Unlike recent top diplomats, he has no experience in government. He's neither a politician, a career public servant, a general, or an academic. And this Forbes piece, one of the few actually pointing out potential positives about that arrangement, that he is a negotiator. He's used to managing people. He's managed in the corporate world. He does have diplomacy experience representing Exxon, which is a worldwide company. There are deep concerns, and I think legitimate concerns, about a conflict of interest of his business interests in Russia. This whole thing with Russia has just been wackadoodle, hasn't it? I mean, with the evidence the CIA has come forth with that the Russians were that somebody from Russia was hacking into DNC email databases and GOP as well, and trying to rig the system for a Trump election. And now you've got Donald Trump, president-elect, basically dismissive of our nation's intelligence, of the CIA, which I think is very troubling when you've got a president-elect openly questioning the credibility of the nation's intelligence departments. Anyway, and so you got to ask, you know, what is American attitude? What's the American attitude with Russia going to be? How would the nomination of Tillerson, if he is approved, affect that relationship? You know, don't you want someone with some diplomatic experience? I don't know. You know, the thing that Donald Trump's going to figure out, though, is that we do have a separation of powers, and these nominees are going to have to be approved. And it'd be very embarrassing to him early on to have some of his choices rejected. So we'll see how that whole thing works out. Indeed. One other thing I wanted to get to, an interesting piece that I ran across that talked about the world's most politically dangerous book, an obscure Russian novel launched by a Russian from the 19th century, Nikolai Chernyshevsky, who wrote an 1863 utopian novel, who became both an inspiration for Marxists and for Ayn Rand, laissez-faire capitalists. Bizarre. And I really didn't note the article for the details of it and the effect that this book has had on two countries' economic systems, so to speak. I did it because of its overestimation of the book as the world's most politically dangerous book, because I will continue to contend and argue that the world's most politically dangerous book is the Bible. I mean, why else would governments ban the Bible? That's what I always, you know, believe me, I teach religion to juniors in high school, or I'm sorry, to seniors now in high school. I always tell them, teach scripture. When you're reading the Bible, you're reading a dangerous book, a banned book. Now, they think it's a boring book. What's so dangerous about it? Well, the things that it contends, the fact that governments are not all-powerful, that they're answerable to standards beyond themselves, that there is a God who raises up and deposes would-be kings and rulers. Maybe we'll get into this more tomorrow. But never forget, when you pick up the Bible, you are picking up an explosive book with truths powerful enough to topple despots and to revolutionize a society. Let's real quick, let's get to random.org or random number generator, and we'll spin up a number between 1 and 2865. 890, the paragraph. This is about the Magisterium of the Catholic Church. The mission of the Magisterium is linked to the definitive nature of the covenant established by God with his people in Christ. The Magisterium, the Pope and the bishops, of course. It is this Magisterium's task to preserve God's people from deviations and defections and to guarantee them the objective possibility of professing the true faith without error. Thus, the pastoral duty of the Magisterium is aimed at seeing to it that the people of God abides in the truth that liberates. To fulfill this service, Christ endowed the church's shepherds with the charism of infallibility in matters of faith and moral. The exercise of this charism takes several forms. In other words, we have our bishops and teachers, successors to the apostles, to guide us in the truth, not to restrict, but to really set us free. We'll be back tomorrow with more. This is The Mike Allen Show.
Thank you for listening to Breadbox Media Podcast. Check out our live stream at breadboxmedia.com. Breadbox Media. Get the app, change the world.